Well, good evening, Larry. On the first day of autumn, and it's 95 here, I think.
95?
God, it's freaking hot, man. It was hot today.
What the hell's happening down there? Does that hurricane bring a heat wave with it?
I think I might call that global warming.
Oh, that's all a hoax.
That's what they perpetrated by the Chinese.
The global warming is nothing but a hoax that you libtards have invented.
By the Chinese created it to get us to buy their solar panels. Mm-hmm. But you have exciting news from the travel front.
Yes, I do. I was planning on flying today, but with the modern marvels of technology, I received an email last night that said my flight had been canceled due to storm activity in and around Dallas-Fort Worth, which was going to be the first leg of my flight to the Great Peach State. Therefore, the computer rebooked me on a flight to leave at noon today and arrive an hour later in Phoenix this afternoon, and to spend all afternoon and all night in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport to fly out at noon tomorrow to fly to the Peach State. And I decided I just wasn't gonna make that flight, so I canceled my trip.
The computer knows best, and they know what you want to do.
I don't think it was the question of knowing best. I think they programmed it to pick the next available opportunity to get the person there based on the fare structure that they've paid.
Yeah.
And I was on a fare structure that didn't give me a lot of preference, and therefore they put me where the computer told them to put me, and that's how it ended up that way.
Which would be essentially the back of the bus.
Essentially, yes. So in the good old days, we would have gotten up and we would have driven to the airport, and there would have been on a message board. Sometimes it would go back far enough, it was even digitized, but they would put in handwriting, flight canceled, and you would have to get to the airport, or you had to call on the old-fashioned telephone and see if you could get through and ask about your flight. And that was hit or miss if you got through to anybody. But now they send you a message that your flight has been canceled.
Which is pretty stellar. And hey, if you use, I don't know if iPhones do this, but they're... And, like Google is reading your email and they know the format of the airline kind of email messages. So they will actually then Google will then update your itinerary and stuff and tell you what time you have to leave to get to the airport on time. It's really quite amazing.
It is. Google knows everything.
They are pretty sharp. Now, roll the clock way back to about 1950 and you would have the people you're talking about. So these would be like the people working from like midnight to 6 a.m. or something like that. And like this gigantic card catalog rotating thing, as people were calling in, trying to check for statuses or trying to make changes, they would file these things into this big rotating card catalog thing, you know, and looking things up by the person's name or whatever. They had all the bookings and stuff in that type of system before anything digital, before computer stuff. That's how these things were managed way back in the day.
I think that kind of predates my time because the airlines have had some computers ever since I've been old enough to know, but how much they've evolved. But that would go way before my time when they were doing
now,
that. But that's the way they used to look up telephone numbers at directory assistance. They had paper directories.
I'd like to thank our new patron this week, David, and welcome. And we really appreciate you supporting the podcast. Let me say it again. We love your tips and questions. We want to hear what you want us to cover. So thank you, Hank, for sending us, I don't know, 6 articles this week. And you can send those to us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or you can tweet to me at Registry Matters. If you're a Registry Matters patron, you can message us on Patreon too. Our patrons are the listeners that make Registry Matters possible. You can gain access to the show early and receive other bonuses like blue balls, and you can access us on the Discord server. If you're not a patron, we'd love it if you became one. And if you are, thank you so very much for your patronage. You made episode 43. Here we are at 43, Larry, the one you're listening to right now possible. Keep sending those tips and questions. And hey, if you can spare a moment or two to give our videos a thumbs up on YouTube or to review Registry Matters on iTunes or your other favorite podcatcher, we would appreciate. And thank you so very much for listening and supporting the Registry Matters podcast. A listener, our friend in Tennessee who always likes to remain anonymous, he heard our last episode where we were talking about birth certificates, and he sent us a copy of Donald Trump's birth certificate, and I sent it over to you.
You did, and I've had it analyzed by a professional, and my professional has concluded that it is a fraud.
Oh my God, really?
Yes.
It's a fraud? That's so it's a fraud. We have a fraudulent president.
Now I hope everybody's not taking that very seriously, that it's a fraud. But it's tongue in cheek what they said when President Obama released his birth certificate, that it was a fraud. And
I did do some searching on that, and you said nope, you don't, there's no background check for the president. It's just like the public would be the ones that would go out, the 120 million people that vote, they're the ones that did the background check for Trump or Obama or Bush and all that before them. And that's true.
That is correct. The security clearance for a president is awarded by the American people.
And I suppose that makes sense.
And if we're willing to elect a person who should not have that clearance, that one's on us. But yes, there's no background check. They don't have to be security cleared.
Are you following the news with the Supreme Court nomination?
It'd be really hard to not follow that. Yes, I'm following it as best I can with my limited time.
What do you think about what's going on so far? Oh, and this wow. obviously is specifically related to the accusation by the lady that something happened 30 whatever years ago that he was pretty nasty to her.
Well, it's really troubling for me in so many ways because I begin by saying that I appreciate and respect the process, and I don't call the process as frauds or say that they're rigged, but the process is a political process of confirming an appointee made by the president. And there's very little guidance afforded in terms of how that process takes place. The majority party right now, which is the Republican Party in the Senate and the House, but in the Senate where it's critical, they decide what they want the process to be. And they are running the process as they see fit. On the one hand, I'm kind of irritated that they stole the seat from Merrick Garland, from the previous president, which they weren't entitled to have, and they managed to invent a whole new process of sitting on a nomination for almost a complete year and ignoring a presidential appointment. But this one is legitimately theirs. Therefore, arguably, the process is whatever the majority and the president wants it to be. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, to make the comparison, I heard an interview with Joe Biden, and constitutionally, the president, his duty is to make the nomination. That's the end of his duty. So Obama made his nomination of Merrick Garland, and Trump made his nomination at the time would have been Neil Gorsuch. But here we are at this one. So Kavanaugh. So they've both done their duty. It is then the Senate that makes the rest of it happen.
That is correct. And the process, for those who are not real political junkies, the majority party runs the process. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is vetting this nomination, has a majority of that committee are Republicans because they're entitled to that perk. That's why you hear Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, is the chair. They're running the process. They will be able to get this out of committee if all the Republicans stick and vote for moving him to the floor. The Republicans have the majority in the Senate. They hold 51 of the 100 seats, so they will be able to move this to the finish line without a single Democratic vote. But that is our process.
Right.
And one who claims that they respect process, I have to respect this process as it goes forward. I am a little troubled by allegations from 3.5 decades ago that apparently have not surfaced until now. That is very troubling to me in terms of how fair is that he's not appointed. Well, I guess he is appointed, but to the would-be Supreme Court justice who's apparently lived an exemplary life in his professional life until these allegations surfaced from so long ago. I feel like that he's not being treated completely fairly, although I would prefer that my candidate be the one to make the nomination. But what I prefer is what we have. We have this president who's made a nomination, and this person is headed towards confirmation. And it looks like that there's a concerted effort to wreck this nomination.
And his poll numbers are like seriously shot. He is a very unpopular nominee to the Supreme Court. And I don't know how much that matters, even in the grand scheme of things, but he's a very unpopular based on these allegations. I believe that they have tanked the support of this guy.
Well, that would be kind of like the when there's a relentless attack. I mean, boy, this will get some of our listeners mad. Well, there was a relentless attack on Hillary Clinton for the last 25, 30 years.
Right.
And when you spend all that energy trying to vilify someone and make them into a boogeyman, it does succeed with some people. And I would imagine that his unfavorable ratings, I've not paid any attention to that, but if he's unfavorable, there's been a constant barrage about this, and it's in a fevered pitch, and it's going to be exciting as a political junkie to watch what Grassley does, because he's trying to move this to the finish line before the midterms, and clearly the other side is trying to keep this from moving to the finish line until the midterms, and somebody's going to win this battle.
If they only hold just that one plus over the majority, how many are in the Judiciary Committee?
I'd have to look at that. It's a small number, probably 15 or so. 15.
But maybe. So they have one plus whatever the middle would be, right?
Well, it when you have a closely divided Senate, it's going to be probably a one seat majority on the committee.
Yeah.
If it's going to be proportionate to the ratio. If the Republicans had 2/3 of the Senate, then the ratio, if it was a 15 member committee, they would have 10 and the Democrats would have 5.
Right.
So, okay. But if you're a majority, you're going to have at least one additional seat.
Fair. And so it's still in the Judiciary Committee level. Is that correct?
That's where it's at now. And once they make their recommendation, now they can report it to the floor that even without a favorable vote, they can say that we'd like the full Senate to decide it. And if he makes it to the floor on any type of recommendation, do pass or no comment, there will be Democrats who will vote for him if they manage to have this vote before the November election, because they represent conservative states that are going to want their, I just believe, I haven't been on the ground polling in West Virginia, but I have a feeling that they support this president. They gave him a 28-point victory margin. I have a feeling that Joe Manchin's going to be under extreme pressure to vote for this nominee.
Certainly. And, you know, I've heard that Jeff Flake, who's I guess you'd call him a lame duck senator, he has said he's at least troubled, if not going to vote for the guy. That makes it a 50-50 split, right?
Yes,
no, I guess it would be 50-49. No, that would take it down.
That would take it down to 50, but then they still have the tie-breaking vote.
Uh-huh, which is Mike Pence. So then you have to have someone that could vote just like present. Not even necessarily they vote against. They just say, I'm here, but I'm not actually going to comment.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if that happened.
Yeah, I'm just playing out the scenario just to like, I mean, it is literally a neck and neck race.
But I don't believe it's going to be so neck and neck. If they get it to the floor, I believe you're going to have half dozen or more Democrats peel off and vote for the guy because their states are for the guy. So you're going to have Indiana, Donnelly, you're going to have Heidkamp from North Dakota, you're going to have Nelson. There's going to be several of these Democratic senators who are going to vote for this guy on the floor.
What do you think happens if he's not confirmed?
Well, if he gets a decline to confirm like they did with Robert Bork back in 87, I believe, then the president would have to put forth another nomination.
Can they get that through fast enough before the November election?
It would be at that point if he goes down, because we're a while before the floor vote, and I don't see how they could do hearings on another one and put it. So I think if the Democrats, if they're running a strategy of delaying, they're hoping that they can pick up that magic majority, which is going to be very difficult for them because the arithmetic is not in the Democratic favor. They're defending 2/3 of the seats that are up, and then they have some vulnerable candidates. I think it's a dangerous strategy, because what happens if they actually shrink in numbers after the November midterms? Then they're
right.
Less.
Yeah.
But the president would appoint another person, and it took Reagan 3 attempts to get it right. He got declined on Bork. Then he had Douglas Ginsburg drop out because he had smoked marijuana. That probably would not disqualify a candidate today, but it did then. And then we ended up with the consensus candidate of Anthony Kennedy. And that could play out again.
That wasn't, you said Ginsburg, that wasn't, is that related to RBG?
No, that's a whole different person, Ruth Bader Ginsburg versus Douglas Ginsburg.
Okay, not related though? I mean,
not
obviously
really,
not the
really,
same
not,
person.
No, but
that would be
really
small man. if it were.
no relationship.
This isn't any sort of criminal process. So does Kavanaugh have a right to confront the lady that Professor Ford, I think is her name? Does he have any right to challenge her?
Well, that's all. Since it's not a criminal court, that's where you are entitled to confront the confrontation clause. This is certainly not a criminal court. I think the answer would be no, he doesn't have that right, and I don't expect him to be given that opportunity. They may testify on the same day if they can work that out, but he's not going to be able to say anything, you're wrong, or confront her in any way. And this is, like I say, it's not even a civil proceeding, it's a political process. And what he's entitled to is what the majority wants him. The process is what the majority says it is. So folks, if you don't like the way this process is being run, then you need to change the majority.
Tell me, we've talked about this a gazillion times. Tell me why you say that they stole the seat from Obama, 2 years ago?
Because their actions were unprecedented in American history. We had a vacancy on the Supreme Court for one full year, minus a few days.
Yeah, it was like 11 and change months.
And there's no history of that happening before. Of the Republicans refused to even consider it. They just announced within hours after, because that question was raised apparently by a reporter, and they announced without even knowing who he might appoint that they weren't going to consider any appointee because the seat belonged to the next president. When did you start being president for part of the term and not president for all the term?
Right. I mean, you could go the other direction and go, okay, he's only been president for one day. Does he get the power to make the nomination? So doesn't he then get that all the way to whatever 4 years of that term would be? So the 365th day or 364th day of the fourth year.
Well, I mean, the practical effects would be that there would be a point where mm-hmm. the process itself would not have enough time left for a president to vet and make a nomination for the hearings if they're going to have a real thorough vetting at the Senate level. There'd be a time where it would not be practical to look at a nomination. That's probably in the last 6 months of the term, because there's a lot of recess time in the summer, and then you go into the electioneering cycle, and you would potentially politicize the process even more than it already is. So there's an argument, but February was a little too early for that. It had not been done before, and I tell people that although you say both sides do it, I hear that. I can cite you plenty of times where the other side didn't do what this side is doing. You go back to the financial debacle when the sitting president, George W. Bush, was begging for the troubled asset restructuring program for TARP funds. The Republicans were not in the majority then, and they would not vote for their own president. And the Democrats gave him the power he requested to try to stave off what turned out to be a cataclysmic economic decline. That when we go back to Watergate, when President Nixon was faced with a vacancy in the vice presidency, we had Democratic control, and the process of replacing a resigned president when Vice President Agnew resigned was the president made an appointment that had to be approved by both houses, which were both under Democratic control. Gerald Ford was nominated. If the Democrats had wanted to play the game that the Republicans had played, they could have simply stalled Ford's nomination his approval and confirmation to be vice president, at which time, knowing that Nixon was probably going to be driven from office, and we would have had the acting president would have been the Speaker of the House, who at that time was Carl Albert. The Democrats could have stolen the presidency. They didn't steal the presidency. They didn't steal the Supreme Court seats that Reagan had when he had the trouble with Bork. They finally confirmed someone for Reagan. And by the time they finally got him confirmed, he was almost approaching his last year of office, because as I recall, it was 87 when they finally got that confirmation through. And Reagan had just over a year left. I mean, where does this end? I mean, that's my point.
Well, a decade ago, the Democrats changed a certain portion of the rules, and then the Republicans changed another portion of the rules, and then they went through the nuclear option because they couldn't get any of the cabinet appointments confirmed. So then they changed the Supreme Court rules to make it that it's just a simple majority. So you have the same thing that you have going on in the House. They were supposed to be the upper house. I think that's the term.
Yes. Well,
so they were supposed to have more debate going on. They were supposed to be more civilized. You know, to hit that 60 vote threshold, you would have to get the other side of the aisle on board.
That is correct. And the Democrats don't have totally clean hands. I'm just saying the hands are not quite as dirty.
I think that's fair.
They've never stolen a seat. They've never stolen the presidency, which they easily could have. And if you think I'm smoking crack, just ask a historian that understands the Watergate debacle and what we were faced when Vice President Agnew resigned and what the levers of power, who were controlling them. And we had Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, and we had a significant majority of seats at that time to work with. And there was no way a vice president was going to be confirmed if the Democrats had not wanted one to be confirmed. And if Nixon had been driven from office under the Constitution, you know the succession line from the president, vice president, Speaker of the House.
Right.
And the Speaker of the House would have been the acting president. People say, well, that's all ancient history. Yes. But when you get more modern history with the appointments to the Court of Appeals, there were some Democratic obstruction when George W. Bush was making appointments, and the most famous name is Miguel Estrada, who had been appointed to the D.C. Court of Appeals, and there was a lot of opposition, so the Democrats filibustered him, and then the Republicans got angry about the filibusters, so they returned the favor when Obama was president. They filibustered a heck of a lot of way more than what the Democrats filibustered under Bush. But turnabout's fair play. So they did the same thing. They filibustered judicial appointments of Obama and administration appointments that needed confirmation. And rather than trying to break the filibuster, which there was an option that leader Harry Reid could have done, he could have said, well, you guys can filibuster all you want to, but I'm going to force you to hold the floor. Just a threat of a filibuster. You're going to have to talk, and you're going to have to hold the floor, and we're going to stay in session, and we're going to stay in session rather than recessing on Thursday or Friday. We're going to stay in session until the damn filibuster is broken. and he didn't do that.
Isn't that the whole reason behind, like, someone is filibustering because, I mean, for lack of, at least in my mind, you are throwing a temper tantrum because you believe so fervently in this thing that you don't want to let it go, and you want to make sure that your voice is heard for as long as you can possibly stand up there and speak. Doesn't that then give the other side going, God, they really think about this really that strongly? Maybe we need to hear them out a little bit and maybe make some kind of concession?
Possibly. That's the whole idea, is that there's a process to slow down what would be possibly mob rule, as the filibuster was a tool devised to put a final check and balance in the process.
But that's all been pretty much removed.
It's been, but there again, the majority has the right to run the process the way they want to. And the Democrats changed the process for a filibuster for everything other than Supreme Court appointments. And the Republicans said, well, turnabout's fair play. So we're going to take away the filibuster. They did nuclear option all across the board for judicial appointments. So now it's a simple majority.
Well, I have one final question before we move on. And that is, it seems to me that if you're just going to accuse some movie star, the consequences are obviously severe, but the repercussions to the rest of the country are not that severe. Do you think that the person that is being nominated should be held to that much higher of a standard than just a person that's down in the political food chain? Does a SCOTUS person need to be held to that much higher of a standard?
Well, absolutely. I think they should be held to a higher standard. The question is it the standard of being a perfect, unblemished individual? There's no one who can be beat that standard. And anyone is subject to an allegation if we take allegations that lack any support other than an allegation in and of itself. If that's the standard, all it takes is an allegation, then we're doomed.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
Because this is an alleged criminal act that's probably beyond prosecution. But criminal acts require evidence to corroborate that a crime occurred. And there is very little evidence. Yes, her accusation is evidence. An eyewitness is evidence. But that's all there is.
And he, to me, in my mind, so she says he did, he says he didn't. at least at that point, they're on par with each other. They would just cancel each other out. You need something else, some corroboration, something of evidence, which I heard from someone. I haven't verified this, that there isn't even a location or a specific date identified that anybody could even go look for witnesses on this date.
It's really tough. The allegation in and of itself is very, very weak this many years later. If we were talking about something that had been brought forward, but we're talking about 3.5 decades.
Yeah, that's a pretty long time. Pretty long time. Well, yeah, so there's that. And that's interesting. And yeah, so we'll see what happens in the coming, I guess, mostly next week. I think they're supposed to hear it Tuesday, Thursday. I forgot which day they were going to have their committee vote.
Time will tell.
No doubt. All right. Well, then this first article was sent by a patron, and the article titles "Lack of Surgical Care in the U.S. Prisons May Cost Lives." This is a Reuters article, and just not a lot of time, but there was a team of medical examiners, and out of 301 autopsy records provided to them, 18 deaths were due to trauma such as hanging or traumatic brain injury. Now, a lot of people spend their time in prison just kind of laying in the bed. So I'm not sure how you get brain injury just laying in the bed. So that would be through either guard abuse or fights, something of that nature, or falling off of a bunk onto the concrete floor. And 51 were due to conditions that would require surgery, 30 of which were associated with cirrhosis of the liver. Were they drinking moonshine in prison?
Possibly were. I hear there's a lot of brewing goes on in those joints.
If you can get the right ingredients, if you can get enough oranges and whatnot, you can make some hooch. But, you know, I mean, a reoccurring theme that we have is that prisons are not good places. And that actually makes me want to ask you this question. You have said to me that you think that kind of sort of just having your liberty taken away, that should be more or less enough as far as what the prison system is. Did I frame that right?
Sort of. That's the beginning of it. Of course, prisons would need to be able to respond to unmanageable inmates. You have behavioral problems with some inmates that have to be specially managed. But you should make prisons where that people can actually improve, that desire to improve when they're going to go out. And I know that people will say, well, they could improve if they want to, but our prisons are no place for improvement. I think anybody,
it's pretty freaking hard.
We fall so far short. In this article, we've talked about healthcare in prisons a number of times through the 43 episodes. And this is just a continuation of what's totally inadequate. And the prisons, if you're going to put someone in a cage, when we put our animals in cages, we generally do our best to make sure they're taken care of. Now, when we put human beings in cages, we tend to be a lot more careless about what happens to them.
We don't give a about the people in the cage, the humans in the cages.
But we would run, I mean, people will spend themselves to bankruptcy practically for their pets.
Yes, that is correct.
When it comes to healthcare and taking care of them. But we have a really completely different attitude about a person we've put in, a human we've put in a cage, who cannot provide these things for themselves. They have no way to deal with their health-related issues. And it's like, too bad, so sad. Should have thought about that. That seems to be right. The attitude.
Yeah, you should have thought about that before you went and robbed the convenience store. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize 20 years later that I was going to have cirrhosis of the liver and diabetes. Hang on. I need my insulin. Let me bang on the door and wait for the guard to respond to me for 30 minutes. Oh, wait, I've gone into a diabetic coma. Oh, I died because I robbed a store 20 years ago. Yes, I realize I should have thought about that. But that, I mean, you know. So anyway, back to we're kind of jerks.
Well, it's something where there's just not a lot of public support for providing quality health care. And I'm not saying that we should provide anything that can imagine, including sex changes and stuff that of some of the extremes I've heard, but we should provide quality basic health care, I would think.
Yeah, you would think that, but that's obviously something of a different mindset that I haven't quite figured out, because, you know, 95% of the people are going to get out of prison. We should probably try and get them out in a condition that would make them more productive than less, so that they can further repay their debt to society and be a on the plus side of the average of being a producer.
I would think so, but that hasn't connected with a lot of folks. That the millions of Americans who revolve through prison doors, we want them to be at their best when they're on the outside. The more they earn, the more productive they are, the healthier the overall society is. Somehow or other, that's not registering with folks.
Yeah. All right. Well, then, so we're going to circle back to this Nebraska thing. And here's my super duper layperson summary is we're going to make two paths that people could potentially end up on the registry. And there's the path that you are in Nebraska and you are adjudicated as a juvenile, and you will therefore not end up on the registry in Nebraska. The other position is you are adjudicated as a juvenile in another state, but they do put you on the registry in that state. You move to Nebraska because that you were on the registry in your previous state, in your home state. When you get to Nebraska, you end up on the registry. And this has caused a whole big kerfuffle that you are actually like super excited that this is an amazing case and you're just excited about it.
Well, it's almost obsessed about it.
So why are you obsessed and why do you think this is so important? And I get really, why is this important to us in a larger context?
It's important to us because it's the real-time example of what judicial philosophy can mean and how important judicial philosophy is. And as I've said so many times on the 43 episodes, I don't think I've had one where I didn't say we have a largely conservative audience, and I recognize that. Most of our conservative audience out there believes that they want judges who don't legislate it from the bench. That's a no-no as far as conservatives say, that you legislate from the bench. And we want those judges who will just interpret what's written on the statute and not give it their own personal spin. This case is so good at illustrating how dangerous those type of judges can be. And magically, our conservative audience, when they start looking at this particular case, they all of a sudden don't think that the textualist view, which is this type of philosophy is referred to as textualism. The late Justice Antonin Scalia said he was a big believer in textualism. You look at the words and they're afforded their ordinary meaning that the English language affords those words, and you conclude, if you possibly can, what the statute means from the text. You don't go into all this kabuki of what would be a better public policy or what they may have meant. They are presumed to have meant exactly what they say according to a textualist. So therefore, my conservative listeners out there, which I appreciate you all very much. I don't think I've got enough liberals listening, so I appreciate the conservatives. But
take what you can get.
With you holding that viewpoint, this case illustrates the danger of that. Because the Nebraska legislature, when they changed their registry requirements in 2009, which became effective January 1st, 2010, I believe it was LB, and that stands for legislative bill. They don't have Senate or House bills because they only have a unicameral. They only have one chamber over there.
It's only 75 people that live in Nebraska.
2 million, but who's counting? And they have 49 senators, they refer to them, and that's a one chamber body. They pushed through LB 285, and they were attempting to comply with the federal Adam Walsh Act, which passed in 2006. And in their drafting, they drafted language to try to broaden the definition of a sex offender. And they were closing loopholes from out-of-state people. And they put language in that said, or anyone who enters Nebraska who is required to register in another jurisdiction. And I paraphrased it because I'm not reading from it, but that's essentially what it says. Anyone who enters Nebraska who is required to register in another jurisdiction. Well, they had this case. They've had two cases. They've had one in federal court where a juvenile moved to Nebraska from Minnesota, and then they've had one in state court where a person who was 38 years old now, but was a juvenile at the time of his sex offense, adjudicated in juvenile court. He moved to Nebraska in 2016. We have two completely different interpretations of what Nebraska law means. The federal court looked at, they did an intent analysis, and they looked at the overall registry scheme in Nebraska, which does not include adjudicated juveniles. And they said, well, even though the state is arguing that this that these words say, or anyone who moves to Nebraska who's required to register in another jurisdiction. We don't think they actually meant that. We think that looking at what they did for Nebraska adjudicated juveniles, that they, why would they think any less of a juvenile from another state? Why would they think any less of that? So we believe that it was an error in drafting because of the fast pace that things move in a part-time legislature and the hundreds of things they're looking at, and they believed it was just a casual oversight in drafting, which means they rendered an opinion that the Minnesotan didn't have to register and that out-of-state adjudicated juveniles don't have to register. Well, then you had Mr. Clemens come along in 2016 and got himself arrested in a barroom brawl, and he was living in Nebraska, had been for at least 2 months from June to August when he got into his barroom brawl, and they ran his background upon arrest, and they said, oh, you're registered in Colorado, you're not registered here, we're going to lock you up. And he worked out a plea bargain with the prosecution to plead to an attempt, which drops the offense by one level of severity, and he got 270 days in jail and 9 months of supervised release. And he decided that he wanted to challenge the conviction because he learned of the federal case, and he said, well, gee, I shouldn't be convicted. There was no jurisdiction for the court to take my guilty plea. I shouldn't be defined as a sex offender. And the Nebraska Supreme Court said, well, not so fast here. We're reading what the words say, and the words say anybody who moves to Nebraska, you are a person, right? Well, yeah, I'm a person. You did move to Nebraska, right? Well, yes, I did. You are required to register in Colorado, right? Well, yes, I am. Well, then what the hell are we missing here? That's what right. The black letter law says. You are required to register. So therefore, they felt that since they are textualist, at least the majority of that court, they felt like, based on the text, that the only sensible ruling they could come up with is that out-of-state convictions are covered, because the legislature could have easily said anyone who moves to Nebraska other than adjudicated juveniles must register. They didn't say that. So therefore, the textualist court says you have to register, and if the legislature doesn't mean that, they can fix it. They can insert a few words and fix that. Otherwise, we would be legislating from the bench if we were to try to come up with something other than what these words say. And we're guided by what the words say. That's what's so fascinating about it, because all of a sudden our people would like a little bit of that spin from the bench, and they would like a little bit of that, what they would call common sense applied to it. And they would like a little bit of intervention from the court, because the court is the equalizer. The federal court kind of took the role of the underdog who said, well, you've got the state apparatus trying to force you to register. We can look beyond what the state apparatus is doing with the state patrol, and we can see that the actual intent of the law was that adjudicated juveniles get treated differently in terms of sex offender registration, and we're going to give you that protection. The state court said, that's not our job. The legislature's job is to protect you from the harms of the registry. If they don't want you to be registered, then they need to tell us that.
But the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the adjudicated juveniles are not required to register. Shouldn't that be the final say?
No, it shouldn't be, and it's not.
But why? I mean, shouldn't the higher thing have more authority, whatever, over the state?
Well, that's very confusing for people, and the federal courts are supreme when it comes to issues of the U.S. Constitution and federal law, but we're not talking about the U.S. Constitution. Or we may be, because there's still litigation pending. These people that were subject to the benefit of that federal decision, they're back in court now because they're about to be lit up on the registry. So right. they've cobbled together some new claims that might rise to the level of U.S. Constitution. But as far as the interpretation of a state statutory scheme and who that statute covers, that's entirely within the purview of that state Supreme Court. And their word is final. So the federal district judge, quite a fine judge. Some people don't like him because he didn't strike down the whole Nebraska LB 285, but he's a very thoughtful judge, Richard Koff. He is struggling with this because he recognizes that he's almost out of bullets in terms of what he can do. And he hates this. He said it when he was dealing with this when it was passed, and he wanted to restrain enforcement of it. But he said, I really can't, because I'm not the one who decides policy issues. I'm just a judge. The legislature decided this as public policy. Well, he's in that same predicament again. He's got the state Supreme Court saying, sorry, judge, you guys, we respect you, but you got it wrong. interpreting our state statute, and he wants to provide relief, and he's out of bullets unless they come up with some federal constitutional claims. And if it were me, I would think one of the more obvious ones is it's an equal protection clause issue, and they probably are asserting that, or they will. If you're an adjudicated juvenile from one state, you're not protected. If you're adjudicated juvenile from within the state, you are protected. So therefore, you've got a class of people, adjudicated juveniles, and they have no protection if they're from out of state. And I just think that that might gain traction with Judge Call.
Okay. But then doesn't that still then push it to a SCOTUS kind of situation? I mean,
if they
run it through the Circuit Court of Appeals and somebody's not happy with it, then they'll say, well, we're going to appeal that. And that's the next stop, right, SCOTUS?
Well, it's back with Judge Koff again. It's back at the district court level because he's faced with having to dissolve the injunction he granted in 2017 when he made the original decision, which the state appealed to the Eighth Circuit and they lost. The Eighth Circuit upheld Judge Koff. But now the Eighth Circuit is out of the picture because Judge Koff is being asked to dissolve the injunction in view of the Supreme Court's ruling. And the parties in that juvenile case that was in federal court, they have put forth some new claims, and I have not gone on PACER and tried to find the case to see what those claims are. But Judge Koff, if he can't find anything to hang his hat on, he's gonna have to lift the injunction, and the state's gonna light these people up like a Christmas tree.
So then, I don't know, out of the 75 people that live in Nebraska, another 5 people will be on the registry?
I think it's probably, I saw somewhere, if I'm not mistaken, and Hank, correct us on this, I think it's somewhere in the 70s of the number of cases of adjudicated juveniles that this applies to, people located in Nebraska that are going to get lit up. And that's tragic. So
the moral of the story is, if you're on the registry in another state and you move to Nebraska, don't get into a barroom fight?
But if you're an adjudicated juvenile, you probably, but anybody who moves, here's the moral story. If you're going to move to, and we don't advise this, we never would advise anybody to disobey the law. But if you're destined to disobey the law and not register, when you move to another state and you're going to start a new life, as this Mr. Clemens said he was going to do, try to stay out of the bar rooms and don't get into brawls with people, because they're going to run you when you get into a bar room brawl. So try not to do that.
Well, I mean, if you end up in a nightclub that gets raided for something that you are, if you're just there and you're having some drinks with some friends and family, and then there's the mob boss sitting there eating his big bowl of pasta, and they go in there and do the raid, they're going to run your stuff also.
You're
kind of screwed from that angle too.
Well, like I said, we don't advise anybody to violate the law, but if you're determined to do that, despite our advice, try to keep a low profile.
Seems wise.
Bars are not a good place to be if you're on the run.
I wanted to talk to you about this. We were on the phone last week, and I was talking about someone, sort of a mutual friend, so to speak, and we're going on a completely different tangent here. But a person's kid is having a hard time after prison. He's not getting favor with the handlers and all that stuff, and he didn't necessarily comply while he was in prison either. And you told me, you said, well, Andy, you're not giving yourself enough credit for doing those things in your time leading up to. And this friend of mine, he is like hyper compliant. And through his time, they have been very favorable to him getting a later and later curfew, and they don't mess with him. They don't make these crazy 2 o'clock in the morning visits or anything like that. Do the handlers go back and look at your record of what you've done so far to see how maybe they should or shouldn't treat you? And I realize that it's still subjective to what handler you do get, but doesn't that seem like that would play favor with you? If you treat them well, they'll generally treat you well back.
It's not a 100% rule that it will work, but it's almost a 100% rule that if you're non-compliant, it won't work. The bottom line is that if a probation officer has all failures, meaning if everybody gets violated and their caseload is constantly zero, at some point their supervisors are going to wonder why there's not a single person on their caseload that's being actively supervised, which means that they can't have a complete group of failures. But they do look at people's records as much as they can. And of course, they're lazy POs who don't look at nothing. But an average PL is going to look at the file, and they're going to peg you for what type of monitoring you need before you've ever even gotten there. They already have an idea of what they're going to be looking at. And when you get there, that first meeting is so important. It really is, because that sets the tone for how the relationship's going to go. And if you're giving them back talk and you're telling them that you don't like this or that from the get-go, it's probably not going to go very well going forward.
One of our patron supporters, he was telling me, and he did his time forever ago, and he said he had a real hard ass, like ex-military, just, you know, Arlie Ermey, if you know who that is. He liked to push back. He was, you know, a young buck, 20 years old or whatever, and he wanted to push back against the handler. And oh yeah, he made it really nice for him. He said he was just constantly on his ass to push curfew times, and, you know, 1 minute late, constantly call him up to the probation office or whatever. Just made his life hell because he pushed back. And I don't know. I just wanted to bring it up. Maybe it's relevant to somebody. Like, maybe you should kind of hyper comply, at least, you know. It's kind of, to me, I think it's like, you don't lock your doors to keep somebody from breaking in. You lock your doors to make you less of a target than somebody that doesn't lock their doors. If somebody wants to get in, if you have a PO that wants to mess with you, they're gonna mess with you. But yes, don't give them any more incentive to mess with you.
Well put, really, because we can't guarantee you that doing everything right is going to give you a smooth ride, but we can guarantee you that being defiant will give you an unsmooth ride. We can guarantee that. It's like the remorse that people express at sentencing. We don't know that you're really remorseful.
Right.
But what we assume is, if you don't express it, you're not. And if you convey to the PO you're going to be belligerent and noncompliant, that is not going to work well for you. You may convey to being complete submissive and cooperative, and you may have a PO that has really mental health issues themselves, and they may still give you a hard time. But it just isn't going to go well for you. It's like the police officer when they tell you to do something. I mean, I hate to tell you, they have the tasers, they have the dogs, they have the helicopters, they have all the power, and you're not going to beat the police by fighting back.
But you could later. This is like having an argument with your boss. Never have an argument with your boss in front of other people, because he's going to win that argument, and ultimately you get fired. You can possibly wait till everything settles down and go and close the door and go, hey, I had a problem with XYZ because of XYZ. And that will come across. You didn't threaten them in front of other people. You do the same thing with a cop. Yes, you should comply. But if he's in the wrong, you have something that you can fight later, where you're on a more equal footing.
Absolutely. And I'm one who doesn't like to comply with unreasonable, particularly unlawful orders, but there's some times when you have to do it until you live to fight for another day. So you have to do everything that they tell you to do, and then try to figure out how to address it later. I know it sucks, but they have the power.
Yeah, they have the weaponry and all the resources to make your life a living hell. And even still in court, they're going to have a whole lot more resources, and probably the table is slanted in their favor, generally speaking. That makes it that much harder of a fight. But still, I got to think that you're better off trying to fight somebody with a lawsuit than trying to fight them on the street when they're telling you to get out of the car and now they've got you in cuffs and all that. That just seems pretty much hell.
Well, it is, and people are told to do things that really are not proper by law enforcement officials. It's unfortunate, but it's probably better to do those things, because they're only going to escalate in most cases when you don't do what they tell you.
And sorry for doing this out of order. Was there anything out of the Nebraska conversation that we needed to circle back and cover before we go on?
The two points I was trying to make that I've written about that have been posted on the website, being the newsletter, is that in issues of state law interpretation, the state Supreme Court is the final say-so. And in terms of judicial philosophy, it's very important. And although you think you may want people who are literalist, it may be that once you consider this as an example, you may not be quite as much for those textualists as you think you are. And that's what often happens. We think we're for something because it sounds so good. You know, we're not for socialized medicine, except for Everybody, the majority of our medicine in the United States is socialized. The VA is socialized. Medicare for senior citizens is socialized. Medicaid is socialized. And most of the people, with the exception of the VA, the VA's got a lot of unpopularity right now, but most seniors are kind of happy with their socialized medicine. Lots of times you think you're for or against something, and when you really get into it, these literal judges are just not exactly what you think they are, because you get an answer like this. And I bet a lot of people in Nebraska, particularly the families of the ones who are going to be impacted. And there's even potential for even a bigger Pandora's box to open in terms of another section of law. And I don't think I want to go into it because it would devour the podcast. But this Clemens decision sets up the attorney general to do a whole lot of mischief if he chooses to use the legal reasoning of this. There's other things that could be subject to reopening that have previously been decided by the federal judge.
Interesting. So Jeff Sessions is going to have possibly some fun.
Well, it wouldn't really be Jeff Sessions. It'd be the Attorney General of Nebraska. But the Attorney General of Nebraska would be able to go back, because this LB 285, the 2009 amendments that took effect 2010, they have been litigated in federal court. They were litigated in front of Judge Koff, and he made some interpretations of state law that an attorney general could easily disagree with based on the reasoning of Clemens, which is the state Supreme Court decision that we're talking about. If he wants to be a horse's patoot, he could open up a whole lot of what previous work Judge Koff has done, and it would be very devastating if he did do that. And I tell people, if I'm smart enough to think of this stuff, and I'm not all that smart, I can just about guarantee that they can think of these things.
I would tell you, Larry, you're giving yourself a whole lot less credit than you deserve on being smart. You might not be smart on the computer stuff, but you've got this stuff pretty well licked.
Well, I appreciate that.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. Well, from the Florida Action Committee website, there's a decision that was recently put down about decision and internet identifier case, where for a whole multitude of reasons, you have to give the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Is that what it is? Florida?
Yeah, the FDLA, Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Yeah.
Yes.
You have to give them all of your, well, I shouldn't say all of, you have to give them identifiers where you're going to communicate with another person, which to me, being an internet guy, every time you put something on the internet, there's somebody on the other end that's possibly reading it. If you communicate with your bank, they say you don't have to register your bank. If you send them a query about, hey, there's a missing transaction, you are talking to a person. If you go on WebMD and you start having a dialogue with someone, may or may not be a doctor, I don't know, that you have some rash that you're trying to get rid of, you are talking to a person. I see a huge number of problems the way that this was decided. And you know, you're not like, I mean, Twitter and Facebook, they already have policies in place saying that you can't be a registrant and be on their platforms. Okay. That's their prerogative. They then say that you can be on a news website, so your local news station, that's directly communicating with one on one, but they say you don't have to register those. But still, I'm really, really bothered by this.
I think we all are bothered by it. I'm not totally surprised by this issue has been around for a number of years now, and it's been litigated in jurisdictions with different differing outcomes. And I give answers that people think that sometimes I support or oppose something, and I'm merely telling you what the situation of the law is. The courts can't solve all of your problems, and sometimes things are bad public policy and they're not unconstitutional. And in pre-show the prep, I talked to you about the death penalty, and I said, well, you know, it's actually not unconstitutional to execute an innocent person. And that's kind of shocking to many, but
it's definitely immoral. It might, but our Constitution doesn't protect you. Obviously, you're now dead. So even if there was, what are you going to do about it? But well, it would be immoral.
But it's unconstitutional to deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process. The due process, there's nowhere in the Constitution where it says that it will be a perfect due process. It just says due process at all. There's no such thing as a perfect due process.
Sure.
Well, in my limited ability to analyze this issue, which I'm very troubled by having to provide all these monikers and screen names or whatever they call these things and email addresses, the assertion that you have a right to anonymous speech is a little bit flawed. If you were to be out in the public square, do you think that you could be anonymous if you were yelling at the top of your lungs and carrying a sign? Would that be? Would the police be able to take pictures of you?
I think you could present yourself anonymously, though. You could wear things that would.
People do that. People do that. Yeah. People. That's why you see people with their faces covered and stuff. But you have no right to anonymity with all speech. That's a limited right. But I think that. In this circumstance, this is going to create lots of problems because although the Florida Department of Law Enforcement says we're good guys, we don't misuse this, and we only apply it to where it was intended, and we've never given it to a public person. No one's asked for it. That didn't mean that they couldn't have given it to the public. They say they just released it in batches. We release the email addresses and the monikers, and you can check those, but we don't tell you who they belong to. Well, now the court has enjoined them from telling anybody who they belong to, as I understand as I read and understand the opinion. But I'm just not sold that constitutionally you have a right to speak anonymously. I think if the police can video crowds of demonstrators, as long as they're not interfering with the demonstration, the courts have long determined when you're in public, you have no right to privacy. You have no right to expectation of privacy when you're in public. Well, how does this translate to the internet? Well, in some instances, maybe you have a right to privacy to communicate with a friend of yours, but where does that privacy end? This is a tough one for me, partially because it's over my head. But
well,
I don't think you have absolute right.
I was going to bring up, so we had the Office of Personnel Management. They got hacked and released. It was millions of records, and these were pretty detailed records. You have Target losing millions of customer data points. Yahoo, a year or two ago, they lost every account they had. I think it was something like 3 billion. So let me just give you the IT tip of the day. If you have a Yahoo account, go in, change the password to something you will never remember, log out, and never touch it again. They cannot be trusted with your information. And I say that if the identity theft people want to get your data, then do you think that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has the capacity to secure your data if these large institutions cannot?
Well, of course they do, Andy. They're law enforcement.
Of course. No one would go near them and try and steal their data. I don't see that they can be trusted with all of this data either. And maybe Target doesn't give them enough information to get at your data. Maybe Equifax doesn't have, they would totally have enough. But now the law enforcement institution has that data too. Then the hackers can then build a much larger profile and get more detailed information about you to perform identity theft or break into your bank account, et cetera. I don't know that they should have this data.
Well, that's a credible argument. The court didn't buy into it, and they did your favorite argument. They argued all this recidivism, and if you read the opinion, it got absolutely nowhere. And there's one person that constantly tells you that that's not a compelling argument, and I don't know who that is, but it.
Yeah, we're gonna have to go track down that person that keeps saying the recidivism isn't a good argument.
It is not a good argument when you try to justify that. So what they're doing is not warranted because any recidivism is too much. And therefore, I prefer to say you just constitutionally can't do it. But when you get into the pissing contest about recidivism, it's just not compelling.
What about why do they focus on the registrants on this kind of stuff when you have people that do actually commit internet crimes? Like I'm going to use my favorite lady in Virginia that she didn't report a sexual act by her kid, and she's on the registry. So now let's pretend that she's in Florida and she's on the registry in Florida. She has to give up all this stuff. She had no sex crime related, but she has to give up this data. But a person that has committed some kind of cyber crime, they're not having to give up this data. They would be the people that actually committed the offense using the internet.
Well, why wouldn't they have to give it up? Doesn't the law cover them? It says everybody has to give it up. What do you mean they don't have to give it up?
I'm saying that they are not excluded. I mean, it says everybody. I'm saying that someone that commits an identity theft kind of crime or other cybercrime, they're not on the registry. They're not necessarily being forced to give up this information.
Well, that's true. They didn't do a heinous sexual offense.
Right, but you could do a heinous sexual offense totally in public and never have touched the internet, yet they're targeting you on the internet. You have someone that has committed a crime. Like if you commit a financial crime, it seems logical that you wouldn't be able to go get a job at a bank. It seems related to me. If you've committed a sexual offense that did not involve the internet, why is the internet your punishment? Whereas someone that committed an internet crime, they don't have to have their internet liberties restricted to some sort of degree.
Well, this isn't restricting your liberty. First of all, it's just merely there's no one prohibited from accessing anything as a result of the statute. They just have to turn it over.
But you can have your liberty taken by not giving it.
Well, that's different. But in terms of there's not a restriction on you using the internet. It's just you got 48 hours or whatever it is to register these monikers, and they actually let you register them online.
Yeah,
which is good. But I mean, it's not good that I'd prefer it not be done, but it's good that in terms of you don't have to make a trip to the sex offender office to do it.
I'm also just completely, what's the word? I'm just scared to death. I use a password manager. It's highly encrypted. It's secure. But every client that I end up with, I have usernames and passwords, and they, you're communicating with someone over this. I have 500 accounts.
You would need to turn them all in if you were in Florida.
That's what I'm fearful of. That seems like a gross amount of data that they would have of that's not related to their interest as far as me doing business with someone.
Well, and your point was addressed in the court's opinion. The court said, well, even though you didn't use the internet, it could be the internet didn't exist at the time you did your crime, or it could be that you have figured out later that the internet provides a more palatable platform of anonymity to be out engaging in your trade. So therefore, the fact that your crime wasn't related to the internet is not significant in of itself. That's essentially what they said.
I understand. Yeah, but now we're into Minority Report with thought crime. Because maybe you might want to think about doing a crime this way, then we're going to restrict you from having access to doing it that way.
Well, you're there again. It's merely giving the law enforcement an investigative tool. It's not telling you can't be on these sites. There's no prohibition in this Florida statute that you can't be on these sites.
Right? I understand. I do feel that there's a first, there's a chilling effect of you going to maybe this. Then if you make an account on 4chan, which is pretty much a massive hate speech website, fat shaming and all kinds of other nasty stuff. Now you might have that, because now you're going to communicate with individuals. You might not go there because you would have to report it because you're going to be quote unquote judged. So now you have a 1A argument.
Right. Well, for First Amendment, but the same thing, if you're going to go do a protest on the town square of Albuquerque,
mm-hmm.
The police are videoing incessantly and there's cameras everywhere. That has a chilling effect. Does it not? That does.
No, I totally agree with you, but in the public square that way, I see that. I feel that if you are in a private club, then you're semi-protected because you're on private property. If you're at a hate speech website, you are sort of on safe ground for you to have your nasty hate speech. That shouldn't be an area that the government has eyes into.
Well, but on the flip side of that, if you're in a chat room that's open to anybody who can just say, I'm over 18 and click here and they start chatting and you start chatting, wouldn't that be a similar analogy? I mean, isn't that kind of public? If you could just hit a couple of strokes of the mouse and you're there chatting with dozens or hundreds or maybe sometimes thousands of people.
I would guess so. Yeah. And shouldn't that be out of the eyes without subpoena power?
Well, no, because it's already open. Any cop who wants to click in there, right? If he sees Joe Schmo 82nd with the E25 or whatever you call yourself, your handle, the cop can be in there watching anyway. You're not private. What would be the difference in that and the cop with the camera rolling when you're out protesting?
God, I guess I think there's an argument there. I just don't have it. It feels something of investigative that the cop is trying to watch the traffic looking for terrorists or hate speech Nazis versus them just videoing for general public safety in the public square. I think.
Well, that's the argument they're making. They're saying that we are trolling, looking through this collection of monikers and screen names we have, and we are catching and apprehending people who are in chat rooms trolling for activity that's prohibited. They alleged in this case that they've busted people that were trolling for sex and unlawful activity. They're saying this is a wonderful tool.
But that they would be able to do that anyway, and if you're out there trolling for the kids, you probably didn't give them that account.
Well, apparently some did because they claim that they've caught people with this information they've collected.
Then this would go back to if you're in Nebraska and you're on the registry in another state, don't get into a bar fight.
Well, yeah, I would say just as a general rule, I'm not even going to say that because people are going to think we're advising. We're going to have people thinking we're advising people to break the law, and we're not.
You should be avoiding breaking the law to begin with. I mean, that's, you know, barroom fights are going to be illegal. Trolling for minors is also going to be illegal pretty much in every jurisdiction, almost across the globe, almost.
So don't do it.
What do you think the cost? If they're submitting a form online, I'm inclined to say that the cost is low, but God, I almost want to say everyone should just go create hundreds and hundreds of accounts in Google and so forth and just start submitting them, just bombarding them with just tons and tons of data so they have just a ton of noise that they've got to sift through.
I think that's been tried before, and they some state proposed a law that you could only have one email address and you could only have one identifier because they didn't want hundreds of them on file.
That's completely I say it's completely irrational to do it that way, but that's I think we could overload their system, just saying.
Well, I don't know enough about that. If it's possible, maybe that would be a viable plan. But that's kind of like overloading their system with going to trial. Everybody should quit plea bargaining and go to trial, but never going to happen.
I think maybe a more realistic analogy was the net neutrality debate 6-ish months ago, where Ajit Pai was the FCC had opened up to receive comments on net neutrality, and they're receiving millions of things a day, and the system, they just said, hey, we're just going to shut this down. It's too many things for us to process. It's called a denial of service attack.
Ajit Pai is the chair of the FCC, right?
Yes, that is who that is. He's a very, very unique individual that has some interesting views on how the internet should run. Well, let me, there was the fires going on in California. This is one of the effects of net neutrality, and obviously not on topic for this podcast, but the firefighters are out there and they are using their mobile devices to manage the fire. They're getting real-time data, satellite images, et cetera, so they can manage. And you've literally got people on the ground that are fighting a fire, and they ran out of data. Their data limit had been hit, and they shut them down to, you know, like 20-year-old speeds. Now they can't effectively manage the fire, and they call Verizon and they go, hey, what's up with our data? Oh, you've exceeded it, so we shut you down to 2G speeds. And it takes them days, and they're like, hey, well, you can upgrade your account. It says unlimited, but unlimited doesn't mean unlimited. So if you want to talk about being a textualist, unlimited on the internet does not mean unlimited.
What does it mean?
Whatever they decide is your cap, 10 gigabytes, 20 gigabytes, and then they're going to shut you. I mean, I guess you have unlimited data.
No, Andy, I am just disappointed. You're going to tell me that a private company with the best of intentions that would never do anything unethical would falsely represent to the paying public that they have unlimited plan, and then somewhere in fine print, it's actually limited, and they would do that. A private company would engage in such a deceptive practice. Are you telling me that that could happen in the United States of America?
That is exactly what happens, and they shut them. But I mean, I shouldn't say it's unlimited. They just made it so that you're now getting your data through a tiny little straw. So you could still get all of the bits. It just might take you 6 years to get all of the bits.
Well, that doesn't sound like anything that an upstanding private corporation that has only noble intentions in the capitalist system would ever do. I'm disappointed that you would say that, and it's just not possible. I reject that.
I'm very sorry to burst your bubble, but yes, corporations do bad things too.
No.
I know. I know it's hard to believe. Well, Larry, I think we're done, and I have an outgoing quote, and would you be so very kind to read the outgoing quote?
Well, I will do my best. Now, you realize that I can't read.
But well, this guy is probably about as old as you, though.
Strive not to be a success, but rather to be of value. And that's attributable to Albert Einstein.
Love it. Love it, love it, love it.
All right.
Are you still coming to the area tomorrow, or did you cancel the whole thing?
I canceled the whole thing. I'm sick of this.
All right, then. Well, then I guess because we were supposed to record this tomorrow, like face-to-face, which would have been exciting.
So share the podcast. How do we do that?
We are going to share it by going to registrymatters.co. That's where you can find the website. You can then share that URL with people. If you want to call and leave voicemail, which I didn't check it for tonight, but 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Of course, please support the podcast at patreon.com/registrymatters. And if you want to get on the Discord server, there will be a link. I'm probably going to put that on the website at some point, but they're in the show notes if you end up getting some email messages about where you can pick up and join us and listen to us record this whole thing or send chat messages back and forth.
How many subscribers do we have on our YouTube? We were striving for 100.
Shoot, man. I haven't even looked at that anytime.
We've surpassed it, I'm sure, but how far?
Oh, yeah. Well, we R-E-G-I-S-T-R-I matters. The last that I saw, we had reached 100. We're at 127.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, man, that's pretty awesome. Absolutely.
And we get likes every week.
We do.
Do they still do thumbs down? Do we get any thumbs down?
Let me tell you this. I have yet to see anybody negatively view us, but you know, I need to update our statistics because we have actually pretty decent numbers of the YouTube videos in there. I haven't been paying any attention to that. But just as an example, there are 52 views from episode 40.
Well, that doesn't sound like an astronomical amount, but we were wondering if we were going to get to our own channel, and we did it.
Yes, we were, and we did. So thank you very much to all of our people that helped get us over the 100. So we have a name channel. Yay!
Well,
and that's all I got.
Well, thanks, Andy. We'll do it again.
Absolutely. Take care, Larry. Have a good night.
Good night.
Bye.